Wilt thou come, wilt thou come, just for once come to me. Wilt thou come, just for once come to me. Will my days fly away without seeing without seeing thee, my Lord. Night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, door of my heart, open wide, I keep. Just for once come to me. Wilt thou come, just for once come to me. Though my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord. Though my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord. Night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, door of my heart, open wide, I keep for thee. Door of my heart, open. Just for once come to me. Will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, night and day, I look for thee. Night and day, night and day, I look for thee. Night and day.
Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to feel your presence. to expand our hearts, to love the whole world as you loved all. We are your children. Awaken us in your light. Om peace. Amen. Now we'll chant again, meditate, and then we have a beautiful song, and then we'll meditate a little bit more before we start.
Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I seek thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I seek thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I serve thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I serve thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I love thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I love thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I seek thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I seek thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I serve thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I serve thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. Just as a fire may burn a whole forest, burn to the root my desires. How shall I love thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? How shall I love thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe?
We'll meditate now for a few minutes.
Where are you going, my little one? In hope these empty streets I went. I've seen a star rise in the east, and I'm looking for a friend to from a lonely valley we ascend. A wondrous vision sent us here. We're looking for a friend. Our soul's long journey we would end. Therefore we've come to Bethlehem. looking for a friend. Good people, let me come with you. Perhaps he's just around this bend. But whether near or far, I too have been looking for a friend.
Another moment of silence. Om peace. Amen. All right, great souls. This is our last class of this series. And as it happens, our last class with me until February because of Christmas. We don't teach classes in, I don't teach in January, I don't think. Do I have a Saturday class in January? I'm looking, I don't, thank you. And then, I'm going to Israel for the month of January. A lot of you are coming with us, but not all of you. Two pilgrimage tours, first group of Americans, second group of Indians, with one American on the Indian trip and one Indian on the American trip, just to keep it, you know, nicely integrated. Okay. All right. So this is our last conversation for this little cycle about Jesus. And I had a thought of how I would talk this evening. I didn't know if anyone had any burning questions that I needed to address before I take over. All right. Or even smoldering questions. Even warm questions. That's all right. Keisha, why don't you just move over a little so that both of us won't be trying to see you like this the whole time. All right. You know, there's... When I was thinking about the life of Christ, I was thinking that there's basically three different aspects of Jesus. I'm sure there's countless others. But in the way of like embracing his life, I think last week I was asked the question, you know, what is the essential message of Jesus' life? And I just gave you how I relate to it in certain ways. But there's basically the three parts of Jesus' life from the point of view of our worship is Christmas, which is Jesus as the baby. Then there is, because the 18 years of his life, which I was saying at the beginning, were spent in India, and we don't have really much about his sadhana and his early teaching. But then he shows back up and he gathers his disciples. They go to the Sea of Galilee. He lives this very free and very happy life training his disciples. And then he comes back to Jerusalem for the extremely dramatic ending of that incarnation. So they're three really different parts of it. I remember when I was with Swamiji on holiday in Taormina in Italy. Maybe it's on the island of Sicily, I'm not exactly sure, right? And there was a mosaic of the of the Virgin Mary holding her baby. And she just looked quite perturbed. she's holding her baby, but she looks really worried. And I think Swami just asked some local, why does Mary look so worried? Well, because she knows, the terrible fate her baby's going to have. But it just was sort of like, really, it's just not necessary that she look miserable right from the start. It's nicer when you think of the joy of giving birth. And even if the sacrifice was coming, I think Swami called her the reluctant virgin, is what he called her. Mary the reluctant was how he started calling her, because she looked so distressed, that was sort of her look, It was mostly it was just bad art, but we had a lot of fun, sort of enjoying the whole, every time we'd walk by it, poor Mary. But the fact is, the Christmas cycle is a very interesting one, especially in the West for this reason. In India, they talk about the classic bhavs. Bhav means like a spiritual mood, and that we can relate to God in all these different ways, and each of them carries with it like a whole attitude, a way of loving, is a really simple way to say it. And actually, Master's Prayer is most of it. Father, Heavenly Father, which is loving, close, but just a little more impersonal. So the divine as Father is a very powerful image. The divine as Mother is the comforter, the compassion. The Father loves us, but in order to please the Father, we have to meet the standard. And the Mother doesn't care what a mess we are. She'll just take us in no matter what. So there's the Father. God is Father. God is Mother. God is Friend, which is, Master says, is the most elevated kind of love, because it's completely free of compulsion. And Jesus speaks of it when he says, "You call me master, but I call you friend." Because the servant is never embraces the master's life as his own. For the servant, his own life is always, as they say in India, in the village. He takes care of his master's work, but a friend stands equal. And in the Bhagavad Gita, there's in the commentary, there's this very touching part, because Krishna calls Arjuna friend, and there's a lot about that. Then there's beloved, which is the Radha Krishna, which is the romantic love. Because these are the way we all love in our human life, isn't it? Then there's romantic love. So when we say the prayer, we say friend, beloved, beloved God, and we don't catch that it's actually beloved, which is different. Then, of course, there's master and disciple. Then we say great master Paramhansa, and so on. But the other one is where you think of God as your own child, which is a hard one for Westerners to think about, because we tend to think about how big God is, and so we tend not to think of that closeness. But in the Indian tradition, almost every deity also has a baby form, and especially the most well-known one is Gopal. And you don't call baby Krishna. Sometimes you call him baby Krishna, but he has his own name. He's Gopala. And many people who are devoted to Krishna, their actual Ishtadeva, the way they worship, is the baby Gopala. And there's an astonishing story in the life of Ramakrishna about a woman, a widow, who worshipped the baby Gopala all her life. And at the very end of her life, he just came to life for her, totally interrupted her devotions and her lifelong routine, and just made everything impossible. She just couldn't do anything because the baby was always there. Just being a real living baby to her. She comes fleeing to Ramakrishna, and he could see the baby Gopal. She and he could see the baby. No one else could see it. Everyone else just thought she was just this totally distraught. But in fact, after a lifelong of worship, the baby Gopal had come to live with her, and behaved just like he did in all the legends, just causing nothing but trouble. Taking her beads out of her hands, spilling the offerings, just really making the devotee quite crazy with it all. But in the West, we have no context for that, except we have Christmas. And we have this time when God appears to us as a baby. Saint Joseph of Cupertino, who was imprisoned. I don't know, imprisoned is probably the right word. He used to, he levitated, and it was, he was very inconvenient for the institutions because he was so outside the norm. And so they kept him in solitary for a long time in a downstairs apartment under the, in the big Franciscan cathedral in Assisi. And if you know the right people, which many of our friends in Assisi do, you can go down into his rooms. And he had a baby Jesus. And his private devotion for years of solitude down there was that he had a baby doll that was his Jesus, that he had that relationship. Now, when you think about it, if we think about it from human terms, what happens when we're around babies? I mean, some people don't like babies, but almost everybody does. My friend, before his sons were born, he absolutely swore that he would not be one of those incredibly embarrassing fathers who did absurd things just to get his child to smile. The instant his baby was born, all sense of dignity just completely left him. And he became, for the duration of his children's childhood, he had no shame. He would do anything to please them, anything to get a laugh from them, because that's what happens, isn't it? You know, there's just this automatic opening of the heart. Now, we have this very confused idea in our mind that somehow we have to keep a distance because, after all, this is God, you know, or this is Jesus, this is the Son of God, however we think about it. And what that creates in us is a lack of intimacy. But if we really try to understand who we're supposed to be, with whether we think of God, Divine Mother, the Guru, how any saint, however we're trying to think of it, the last thing we want is self-conscious barriers. I mean, self-conscious barriers are the death of love itself. Yesterday in my class last night, I was talking about the fact that at a certain point in my life, I realized that even though I was working for Swamiji, this was in the very first years, I was working for him as his secretary. The word that is more appropriate is personal assistant, but that word didn't exist at that time. So I was called his secretary, but I cooked for him and I spent hours with him pretty much every single day, or 6 days a week usually. But I realized that I was so self-conscious, I was so worried about doing the wrong thing, and so somehow a little bit too in awe of him and just sort of imagining a kind of attitude toward life that was just waiting to criticize me or just waiting to be offended by some careless act of mine, that I gradually realized that I was less considerate and less attentive to him than I was to anyone else in my life, because I just wouldn't even do the most obvious thing. You know, bring him a cup of tea, or, you know, offer to clean up the desk, or just anything. Because I was always worried. I was always, in other words, thinking about myself. And I finally decided, in a weird way, to just treat him like any other friend. And actually, everything got a lot better. Because what we're trying to do, if you think about our relationship to God, is we're trying to be absolutely fearless. Again, in the class I've been doing about conversations with Master, conversations with Yogananda, there's lots of stories about how Master knew the minds of all his disciples. He knew what they were thinking at all times. Swamiji said, "At first I found this very disconcerting," is how Swami said, because when Master said, "I know every single thought that you think," and Swami said, it wasn't that Master invaded your mind, as Master himself said, "If you don't invite me in, I don't come in. But if you have invited him in, then he comes in." Swami said, at first it was very disconcerting, but then he saw it from the other side. And he realized then what is the necessity for any self-protection or any pretense? I remember I went through a cycle with Swamiji also. He'd given me a job assignment it was way beyond my capabilities. And I was under the impression that the competent people were just born competent and never had to learn and never asked for help, one of the many delusions I've had to work my way through. So I never let anybody help me, even though I was totally incompetent. And that's how incompetent people remain incompetent. I gradually figured that out. But this went on, it actually went on for like about 2 years. Swami was constantly trying to help me, and then he was constantly trying to push me so that I would begin to understand. And I would always say, yes, yes, of course, yes. And then I just couldn't do anything. I just couldn't function. I couldn't do the job. So finally, he just before he fired me, he said, basically, you always wanted to say yes and look good. You always wanted to appear like a good disciple. But he said, I knew you were just getting more and more frustrated and actually angry, which I was. And he said you wanted to appear like such a good disciple. And then he said, but you never fooled me. You know, it wouldn't have taken much intuition to see that I was just pretending. But I remember when he said that, I said back, oh my gosh, what a colossal waste of time. You know, all this time I've been trying to make an impression when it was completely, I wasn't fooling anyone. Now, that's the wrong attitude to have in our relationship with our teacher, with God, with the guru, anywhere inside. So the opposite of that, you see, is the baby. Like, who's afraid of a baby? Who's concerned that the baby's not going to think well of me? One of the reasons people like babies so much is they're so marvelously undiscriminating. You know, they just can't tell the difference. They can't tell. They can't tell the difference between good and bad people. They just love everyone. P.G. Woodhouse has a very funny story, and the story is called The Shy Man. And it's written from the point of view of the dog, actually, who are also dogs, are quite undiscriminating in their love. And so you read the story for a long time, and then you gradually realize that the man that the dog is writing about, who is his master, is actually a thief. And the reason he's so shy is that it's the police who keep come looking for him, you know. And the dog decides he's going to help his master not be so shy. Gradually brings him out, but gets him arrested by the police. But that's the story of undiscriminating love. So whenever we find ourselves around babies, we always find our heart opening in a very fearless. And also, the baby needs to be cared for, doesn't it? So what we end up doing is we have to give. Any person who's raised a child, which I, in this incarnation I haven't, but I remember. You know, it's just, there is no self. Again, my same friend, before my sons were born, he said, I thought I was a kind of unselfish guy. He said, you know, I was pretty generous and pretty willing to take care of others. He said, I discovered after I became a father that there's no such thing as being unselfish. He says, there just is no self. He said, when I became a father, I simply ceased to exist. The only reality was taking care of my children. He said, I really discovered what it meant actually to give, which I just never knew before, because the baby can't survive unless the parent takes care of it. It doesn't care if you're tired. It doesn't care if you've had a bad day at the office. It doesn't care if you haven't eaten. It just doesn't matter at all. It's, you're there to serve. So all of this is what we're trying to do as devotees, isn't it? And so the bhav of taking care of the baby demands of us exactly what we're trying to give. And when someone, a devotee in the Indian side, there's an American woman who was a good friend of Ananda. Her name was Hari Priya. She's passed away now. And she was a disciple of Ananda Muni Ma. And either by her choosing or Ma giving it to her, I don't know which, the bhav she came was that she had baby Gopal. And she had a little murti of baby Gopal. And she just had to take care of that murti as if it were a living child. And Jyotish tells the story of, you know, when he went to visit Ananda Muni Ma, once he took a list of questions from Hari Priya, you know, having to do with when she travels, how should she deal with this, and you know, just, and Ma gave a very, very specific set of answers, all based on the fact that this murti is the living image of God, and you must treat it like that. And that's why in all the Hindu temples, in the pujas, you know, they feed, they bathe, They dress, they change their clothes, they take the Murtis to their summer homes, they put them to sleep, you know, they take naps. This is a living presence. But it is a living presence. Because everything is a living presence. And so in our, the Christian tradition, so to speak, the Western side of religion, at Christmas time we get to do this. Because very little else in our culture, because we're so, the way we are, about just not being able to be devotional in public. You know, you go to Latin America, you go to India. When we took over this temple in September of 1994, prior to this, we had an office suite over on California Avenue, just a few blocks away. We were there for a number of years. And then the day, it was on a Sunday, when we were going to take possession of this building. At the beginning of the Sunday service, I announced to everyone who was in the temple that when the service was over, we were going to take all the holy objects from where we were, and we were going to process from California Avenue over to here. We were going to chant and carry all of these objects over. They all looked at me like, oh, really? I said, yeah, really. That's what we're actually going to do. And I said, you'll see. It'll be fine. I mean, people are so like, what are we so afraid of? So a few people managed to wiggle away, but mostly we got everyone. And we just had a marvelous time. We just went down the sidewalk chanting, and we were carrying all these pictures. It was so beautiful. We came in the back doors and came up. It looked very different at that time. We laid them all up here. We had a kirtan. It was magnificent, absolutely magnificent. Later, I told Swamiji, I said, oh, Swamiji, we had this procession. We chanted up the street. You know what he said to me? Next time, ask the police to close off El Camino. That was a nice start, kids, but let's see a lot more of it. But the one time we let ourselves do it is Christmas. And it's a learning for us. And now, in our Christmas Eve service here, and most of you have been to it, some of you will be here for the first time, you know, we do a very elaborate, now we do a live creche, meaning we have people in costumes and we don't have a live baby. For many years, the couple in the community that had that most recently had a baby would be Joseph and Mary and the baby. But babies varied a lot in their ability to carry the role. Every so often you'd get a great Jesus who would just sit on his mother's lap and beam the whole time. But sometimes you've got Jesuses who just cried. And then we had one Jesus who just went and was nursing under the wrap. And I mean, there was never any Jesus there except for the tiniest little bit of the baby's feet. And that was the last time we did it. So now we use a doll, a Murti. But we've been using the same Murti for so long that it really, it's really a living Jesus. And so by the time we've built the whole creche in front of us with this Murti, he's actually from the Vatican. He's not from the Vatican, he's from down the street from the Vatican. He's an Italian Jesus. He's a baby Jesu. But by the time we've all focused our devotion on that, there's this tremendous real feeling that God has descended among us. So but what we're doing is, you see, we're acting out something that's true. I've talked about this. The very important aspect of all worship and all meditation, I mean, in the practice of meditation, the whole path of self-realization, which is we are using our creative imagination and our discipline. And in our liturgy, we're using visual beauty and dance and especially music to bring us into a higher vibration that's actually there. It's like this that we call the real world is really just a tiny little fragment of the real world. And we're so busy dissipating our energy that we don't realize that Jesus has been born among us, that the Savior has come. And so that's a very, very fundamental part of being a disciple of Jesus, being a devotee of Jesus, is that we start with him as the baby. And what that also represents, and this is the symbology of these stories, because everything about an avatar's life isn't only the life itself, it's the deeper lesson that we can see underneath it. So Master writes a lot, especially when he's writing in a devotional way about Christmas. He talks about the baby Christ consciousness that's born within us, and then how we have to take care of that baby Christ consciousness exactly as we would take care of a baby. And all the things that I was saying before about how we can't just ignore that baby because the baby won't survive. I recall reading that in high schools, trying to get teenagers to understand the responsibilities of parenthood, that in some cases they've given the children a single raw egg and they've had to take care of it for like a week or something. And so they could never leave it behind. It always had to be with them. And they always had to be able to see it and know that it was safe. And you can, you know, just sort of imagine all the things that they would have to think about to do to keep that raw egg from breaking, which would just give them an idea of what it would be to nurture a baby. I remember when one of the first people I knew who'd had children, I was helping her one day and I was bringing in her groceries. And I brought in 3 bags of groceries, then I brought in her little baby son. Now the groceries I just left on the counter. And I brought in the baby son and I thought, huh, I don't think I can just set him on the counter like I did all those groceries. You know, he was 1, 2, 3, 4 bundles, but he had a wholly different reality. And just for a second I realized, oh my, this is her life, isn't it? You just don't put him on the counter. Now, if we're going to use that image to talk about the Christ consciousness that's born within us, how attentive are we to it? You know, how constantly do we nourish it? How do we keep it from suffocating because it's not in the right atmosphere? How much are we offering it love? How much are we protecting it from wrong vibrations? And so this is also where, you know, the baby Jesus gives us an idea of what we're trying to become, because we know what Jesus came to be. We know the end of the story. And that's, we're pretending that we don't know because we know the whole end. So we know that this little baby Christ consciousness becomes strong enough to bear the sins of the world on its shoulders. But how does it get there? And so that's another way that the image of the baby Jesus becomes an extremely important part of our devotion. First, it gives us the courage to love without restraint. It allows us, in a very real sense, to become childlike in our loving. I mean, that's what my friend was saying in order to get his sons to laugh or smile. You know, he just became as silly as he could possibly be. And that's the kind of freedom that we need to have in our relationship with God, no pretense at all. And also that the baby is small enough to hold within us, to make it our own. You know, some people mistakenly long to be parents because they think they're going to own the baby. Right. I mean, every one of you who are parents are shaking their heads, but I know this is the immature idea. Somebody will take care of me. Somebody will love me. I'll have something of my own. This is why the high school girls were given the egg, so that they would understand what this is about. But also there is something so intimate about the baby also, that we really can. So the baby Christ consciousness we can really hold to ourselves. You know, it's the idea of a living creche acting out the birth of Jesus in this way. I understand it was St. Francis who started the tradition, that it didn't really exist until he was there. Now, Francis's role in the Christian church at the time, if you remember any parts of his story, he had this idea to reform. He wanted to start a new order in a different way because there was a lack of vigor to what was going on. And it was controversial what he was doing. And then the Pope had a dream in which he saw this little monk that the church building was breaking, and this little monk was holding up the church. And so the Pope was positively inclined because of that superconscious dream he'd had. So Francis's role, and of course in his lifetime he drew thousands of people, and Sister Claire, they drew thousands of people to an extremely demanding way of life, which of course is only possible if there's joy sufficient to carry you. You know, if it's only misery, if it's only sacrifice, if it's only suffering, people won't do it. But what appears that way is compensated for by this wonderful sense of joy. And so all the stories of Francis are about the austerity, but the real story about him always is the joy that it was behind, that was behind it. So you can see him when you start thinking of the story in a human way, that Francis wanted to bring, you know, this sweetness. Francis communed with Jesus all the time. Master said that every night Francis would walk through the woods and Jesus would walk with him. You know, we have stories of these saints. Teresa of Avila, Jesus would just come and sit with her in his cell, her cell. You know, she would excuse herself from her visitors in the parlor saying, "Someone is waiting for me in my cell." But she wouldn't tell him who it was. But because the masters can materialize whenever they choose. So Francis is trying to inspire in his monks, you know, the kind of intimate relationship with Jesus that he has. So he conceives of this idea, as they said it, in the woods. And someone told me recently that instead of an image of a baby, he actually carried light in his hands, that the baby was symbolized by blazing light. That was somebody who lives in Assisi who's familiar with all these stories. But it was this, Jesus is coming. And so we have, you know, this tradition of Mary and Joseph, which is, Master said all this is true. Let me put it this way. Master took a pilgrimage in the Holy Land, and his words were, almost every pilgrimage site is true. Swami said that the Last Supper site is not true, and even the people who say it just say this is somewhere near where it was. Nobody really seems to know. But Master specifically said that the cave where the stable was, where Jesus was born, Master said that's an authentic place. That's really where he was born. And it's a cave, and then there's a little manger site, and there's two little places right like this far apart, which is where he was laid in the manger and where he sat with Mary. And then it's a big cave, not a big cave, but a small room that's also a cave. And Master said that's exactly where it was. So you have all this marvelous story, you know, of Joseph and Mary being exiled from their families and forced out into this, you know, other place where they had no home, where no one would take them in. And then they finally have to seek shelter in this cave where the animals are stored. And then the tradition says at midnight, whether true or not, then the baby is born. And, you know, Joseph and Mary themselves were highly elevated, extremely elevated, enlightened souls. So just imagine it all. You know, it takes you completely out of the mundane into something completely other. And for the season of Christmas especially, you know, we should spread our arms wide and open our hearts wide and just draw all that in as deeply as we can. Then you add to it master's statement that the three wise men who came to visit were Lahiri, Babaji, and Sri Yukteswar. Now, whether they came while Jesus was still in the manger, whether they came 2 years later, where they came from, it's all not exactly known. But somewhere in all of this, there's the whole power of this path. There's the whole power of God's commitment to bringing enlightenment to truth-seeking souls. A prayer of love went up from earth, and you responded. A ray of your light burst out from the heart of infinity through night skies of consciousness and was born on earth for the redemption of mankind in human form. Now, there's times for philosophy, and then there's times for just childlike devotion. I think Christmas is the time for just childlike devotion. We don't need big philosophical stories. You know, a prayer of love went up from earth. Our human griefs, your love alone can mend. And so he's born, he's come. Just like that, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. I mean, we can just contemplate that story over and over and over again. And greater can no love be than this. That's how this is why we say that festival every single week, because there are so many phrases in there that speak to us so deeply about everything about the spiritual path. And here's the most marvelous part. This is Sister Gyanamata. Sister Gyanamata, you know, became completely free in that life. She writes to Master. She said, "I know, sir, that you had a great work to do, that you came to deliver the message of Kriya Yoga, that the Masters sent you, that Babaji sent you." And then she says, "But I like to think you came for me." And the wonder of that, you see, is it's absolutely true. It's like the entire infinity, the entire power of God is for each one of us personally. Isn't that just an amazing thing to think about? Think about it, they have it in the Radhakrishna story, when Krishna, in the village where Krishna was growing up, he was as the foster child of Yashoda. He was a king, but his uncle was determined to kill him, so as a baby he was spirited away and sent to this humble village and raised by these humble cowherds. And so his childhood was spent in this great freedom that the rest of his life didn't have. And Radha was one of the cow herders, and then there were all the gopis. And they all had this wonderful romance with Krishna until, and the cow herd boys also loved Krishna in the same way. But the story is usually about the romantic love. So Krishna would meet them all in the forest in the middle of the night. And there's one story which is often depicted in pictures where Krishna was there and they were all dancing. And every gopi thought Krishna was only dancing with her. And so the painting of it is you see all these different gopis and then there's a Krishna for each one. So Krishna multiplies himself. So there's as many Krishnas as there are devotees who love him. And so this, again, it's hard for us to get our minds around this. But Master lives, God lives equally in every one of us. And it was a prayer of love went up from earth, goes up from creatures everywhere, this call for redemption. And Christmas is the time just to, he was born for me. Even if you might be that one stray brother left behind that Master promised to come and pick up. But he was born for me. And then, as many as received him. So whether or not we actually receive that gift, he came for us, but whether or not we receive it is where our part comes into it. So, you know, think about these things in the next few weeks as we come up to Christmas Eve service and as we meditate. Just enter in with as much, with as little restraint. You know, don't restrain your heart's feelings. This is private between yourself and God. You know, this is the birth of the baby. If we were new mothers about to give birth to our first child, think how just beyond thrilling that is. And that's what we're dealing with here. The baby is coming, but on a level that human birth tends to disappoint, whereas divine birth doesn't disappoint at all. You know, and then you have Mary, you have Joseph, you have all of these other parts of it, but now we're thinking only of Jesus. So then the other part of it, and I'll just begin a little bit of this. I talked some more about Easter last week, so I don't have to touch it as much. But Jesus also came in a very practical way to teach us, you know, as a friend, as an example. And we don't know him because we don't know those 18 years. Let me try to think about how to say this for a moment. You know, the stories of the life of the great masters. I read part of a book that was about Ramakrishna. I've read lots of biographies of Ramakrishna and his life. But this book was a collection of the legends about the life of Ramakrishna. And what was so interesting at the beginning of the book was it said, sometimes legends are more true than truth. And the reason legends grow up around spiritual figures is because if we describe them in normal human terms, people don't understand what we're describing. And the only way that we can begin to get a feeling for what we're describing is to elevate it beyond the ordinary. I remember when I was probably in the 70s, when I was writing a lot of different publicity for Ananda, and I had written this little brochure about what the community was or something, and I wrote another one, and Swami just didn't think it was what was needed at the time, and he sort of threw it away, as he often did with my writing. And then he wrote this story of how he thought we ought to present Ananda. And he started with all the miracles that had happened and all the unusual events that had made it possible, and he barely gave any facts at all. It was all just this story of this miraculous descent of spirit manifesting itself as the Ananda community. Almost no one in the community liked it. They all thought it was just way over the top. For about, I think actually 7 or 8 years, we had absolutely no literature about the community because he wouldn't print the one that I'd done and no one wanted to print the one that he'd done. And we were just frozen in the middle. So people would sort of ask why we didn't have anything, and that was my department. I was just caught between it. I couldn't deal with it because people were just so pragmatic, I guess. I don't know what the words were. Everything, now, I actually still have it in my file. Now when I read what Swami wrote, it seems perfectly fine to me. I can't understand why anybody even reacted to it, but we couldn't. And this was Swami's, this is the whole point. Swami said, Ananda is so different than it's so completely outside anybody's experience. He said, if we describe it here, they automatically think of it here. They just, you know, no matter what we say, they drop it down to something that makes sense to them. He said, so for them even to come close to what we have, we have to start very high so that they'll be able to feel what it is. So this is it with a lot of the life of spiritual beings, and that's how everything gets more and more, you might say, exaggerated or more miraculous or less and less human, is because people are trying to say something. And they want you to know that something happened here that it has no relationship to everything else you know. So they start creating realities that are outside. Because, as this man was saying, it's more true than just the prosaic facts. Now, I was going to say all of this because some of the most touching stories in the life of Jesus to me are just the little parts where he comes and finds his disciples. You know, he walks by the seaside and he sees one and he says, "Follow me." And they just leave what they're doing and they follow him. Now, if you think that Jesus was actually born to these people and they were really in the seen community and they really knew each other, in fact, some of these people are his cousins, part of that story may be that's where the story resumes again after the missing 18 years. So it wasn't that they were seeing Jesus for the first time, it's just that he had come back. I mean, that's an interesting explanation. But truthfully, I prefer it the way it's written. I prefer that Jesus just walked by, turned, and they knew who he was. They just knew who he was. And all of a sudden, everything else they were doing, what did it matter? Because here was what the purpose of all of life was. It was standing in front of them. And, you know, Swamiji talks about that, reading Autobiography of a Yogi. I recognized Swami as soon as I knew who he was. It's not, I mean, and I'm sure many of you have either met Swami or met someone on the path or found Autobiography, or there was a moment where just everything came together and you realized, oh, this is what I was born for. This is who I am. So I love to contemplate, you know, what kind of power did Jesus have? That he could just walk by and people would turn and that was it. Then they would turn their back on one life and completely take up another. And then, you know, he took all these disciples out just away and they went off. And were they going to Essene communities? That's some of the story. Were they camping? Were they just ministering from town to town? You know, the Bible has all these different stories. But during that, and it was only, at least in the Bible part of it, 3.5 years, you know. But during that time, Jesus is giving them, you know, everything that they're going to need to carry on for the rest of their lives. And we know from our life experience, you know, what enables us to make a shift like that is the experience of joy. You know, we will do it because it's important to us, but what holds it to us, there was a woman, I'm going to take a break in just a moment. There was this woman who came to Ananda. She was a very promising devotee, and Swami tried to help her, and he included her in small satsangs and things like that. But after a few months, she started declining the invitations to be with the group, because whenever she was with Swamiji, she said, she couldn't remember her problems, and so she wasn't working on solving her problems. And of course, she actually, of course, didn't last long in the community, because when you're in the company of someone whose consciousness is elevated, your consciousness automatically comes up. And all of us have had experiences in our lives where we know we can do it, you know, and we don't remember all the obstacles. All we remember is this is what it is, this is what I want. And then, of course, the vrittis come, the past karma comes. Last night we sang, "Where Has My Love Gone?" They sang it, Keshava and Navashan. It has that line in it. So many of you know the song. "Strange how when love calls, memory stays, calling across the tides of our days." And as I understand what that verse means is, even when we're called, even when we know that this is my life and this is all I want, all those past desires, you know, strange how when love calls, the memory of all that stays. And it keeps calling us. It keeps calling us back like this. And so Jesus just you know, was there calling them to, calling us to the to this extraordinary freedom of life in God. Now, how much courage do we have to take that part of it too? How much have we nourished the baby so that the baby can now not merely depend on us, but also lead and inspire us? So let's take a few minutes break and then we'll come back. Do we have enough memory tonight?
We do.
Thank you.
We made sure.
Thank you.
In fact, we have 2 hours and 53 minutes left.
Okay, I won't use it. Children's book published by the Catholic Church that is all about Jesus at the age of 12 getting on a ship with Joseph of Arimathea and traveling all over the world, visiting a Catholic children's book visiting a kind of brotherhood of which the three wise men were part. Yeah, it's a. I don't know. Helen gave it to me. I think she bought it for one of her grandchildren. But it was like I'm looking at this book. It's like you're. It's a wonderful book. It's just a complete story. The real story. But it's just creeping in all directions. And there's countless examples of people saying this. And just gradually, it will become the new theology, because of the age that we're coming into.
Yeah.
I mean, you just sort of like what. What does Master really intend when he talks about the original Christianity? I mean, like, what is it going to look like? You know, what, because all these institutions are Kali Yuga institutions.
Just of the second coming?
Yeah, just in terms of the way Master, what is Master really launching? I don't think he's launching that the Hindus and the Christians will respect each other. I think he's launching something completely else. You know, the dissolution of a lot of things. I mean, the mere fact that we bought a Catholic church and that we've installed a self-realization church in what used to be St. Aloysius. And if you go to Assisi, you go to what everyone calls the Minerva Temple, which was a Minerva Temple that the Catholics took over. And then now it's a temple to Mary. But at one point it was one thing, and then a new expression came and it became something else. And this temple was one thing, and then a new expression has come into it. I'm not looking at it today and tomorrow, but just in a long rhythm.
And it's been 25 years already.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like, what?
I think Master's playing the long game.
He's playing the long game. When we were buying this church, we had a group of Italians visiting us, and only a few of them spoke English, but when they actually understood that we were buying a Catholic church, there was all this, like this. You know, it was sort of like I said, what do you mean buying a church? You know, the Catholics don't sell their churches. Well, here they do. You know, they absolutely could not get their heads around the fact that we were able to do this. But we did, so there we were. even the word church, I mean, they can't use it in Italy because there's just no...
Well, it's church with a capital C.
Well, you don't start churches. There's just the church. You don't.
By law, right?
In America, you start churches. That's why we're such a strange country.
Okay.
But isn't it the law that you can't start a church?
Well, actually, that was one... You know, when Ananda was under litigation in Italy, part of the problem was that... Let's see, the government... There was freedom of religion in Italy. There was freedom of religion in Italy if you were an authorized religion. And the government allowed the Catholic Church to decide what an authorized religion was. Surprise, surprise, there was one, and it was the Catholic Church. And then just before our legal case really made its thing, apparently the Buddhists were also recognized as being an actual, but we, Ananda, were an association, and we actually did not have freedom of religion in Italy. So when we tried to, and this man, this crazy man who filed the suit against us, we were arrested under criminal statutes for trying to brainwash weak-minded people because talking about, because we weren't a real religion, so we were just trying to brainwash weak-minded people. And that's why our people actually went to jail for a week, because it was criminal what we were doing. But we had a very good judge and we had God on our side. So after 7 years, 5 years? 7 years, it seems like it took. They finally got the case before the judge. The judge not only ruled that the man who filed the case was mentally unstable and the entire thing. There's a category in Italian law that is more than innocent, is that there was never any grounds for this to have happened in the first place. There was no crime was committed. So he exonerated us entirely. But then he wrote a decision which changed the definition of what was a recognized religion. So not only did we win, but we actually, our case, and I mean, this is how it's explained to me, our case actually liberated, it just changed the whole concept. And there'd been lots of small groups that were being persecuted by the Catholic Church under the Italian laws. And what happened to us ended up making that difficult or impossible.
So are we still called an association
then? I'm not exactly sure of the details. And so all that I've told you, I wrote in my book, and I know it's true because I got Shivani to say it, but I mean, clarify it for me. But that's sort of what happened. So in America, we also changed the laws. The lawsuit that we had with Self-Realization Fellowship was an attempt on their part to get exclusive trademarks on universal terms, which the American Trademark Office was allowing because they didn't know. When somebody says Paramhansa Yogananda is an original word, how did they know? I mean, we own him. How did they know? And in words like, you know, vata, pitta, and whatever, and kapha had been copyrighted, citta had been copyrighted, self-realization had been copyrighted, just words that were generic. But after our case, that whole process was stopped, and because it was appealed, our case, it was published. And it stopped that process from happening. That's why John's book, John Parsons' book, Fight for Religious Freedom, he said ours was one of the most important religious freedom cases that had happened in decades. Because this movement was happening to make exclusive that which had always been universal. Because, I mean, no one could copyright the name Christ, but they did trademark the name Paramahansa Yogananda because they didn't realize what was being done. So, okay, back to Jesus. So, do we have any questions or comments before we go on with what we're talking about? But you know, these are all, I mean, even though all of that was a big digression from Christmas morning and the baby Jesus, it isn't really, because we're working with the power. I mean, this is the paradox of the spiritual path, which is so remarkable, which is we have the baby Jesus, which we just love. And, you know, Jesus lives in my house during the 11 months before, and I have to, at the end of the Christmas season, I have to put him back in his box, and we always have a conversation about it, you know. He's going to go into hibernation because, you know, we've all become so fond of him. It's hard to put him away, and I sort of apologize that he's going to have to be put away. And then there's the time when I bring him out, and I brought him out a little early this year. He's been sitting in my hallway. And every time I walk by, you know, just, hi, Jesus, there he is. It's just so nice to sort of have him all ready there again to inspire us. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it, and this is, you know, the man in Taormina talking, Mary's holding the little baby on her lap, but she knows what she has, and she knows the extraordinary, just, you know, mind-bending power of Easter, of the whole cycle of Easter. And last week I was talking about coming in on Palm Sunday and just, you know, everyone is so, the intensity of the experience and Jesus being arrested and all those things that happened. There's a place, for those of you who are coming to Israel in January, there's a place that is said to be, that was the house of the high priest that Jesus was taken to over that long night when he was arrested. And it underneath there's a prison, there were prison cells. So you can go down a layer or two and you get down into caves, which they believe, was where Jesus was held. And I certainly felt something extraordinary there. But when you're there and you're just down in these caves and just the whole extraordinary conflict of good and evil and light and dark and the war of Kurukshetra just being acted out, you know, in this astonishing story. And it's there in the baby too. You know, it's all really happening. And our relationship to it, it's like, you know, that we grow with it. We start with the little baby growing in us, and then we meet Jesus at the height of his power, when the magnetism of his presence was so great that he could just walk by and you would know who he was and you would turn and follow him. And that's what we have to practice. And that's sort of where I was going with that before we stopped. You have to just practice that. You have to practice that every day. You know, of Jesus walking by every day, how would I respond? I had the opportunity for so many years in so many circumstances to be in Swamiji's company. And one of the things I absolutely loved about it was it kept me awake and ready. You know, just he was so full of energy, and it was not that he never rested or that he never let down, you know, his guard or anything like that, but just the basic vibration that was around him just affected you. And whether or not we are in that constant company, because Swamiji, once when he was with Master, and you know, again, just feeling that the uplifting presence that you can't forget if the physical form is right in front of you. You see, it's not like Swamiji has gone away, or Jesus has gone away, or Master has gone away. It's that it's easier to forget because the physical body isn't in front of you. So what we have to work with ourselves, which is every day we're being called. Every day Jesus is walking by the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and every day we're standing on the boat, and then there's the, just to skip, you know, because I'm not going to have time to mention everything, but when Jesus was resurrected, he appeared to his disciples intermittently for 40 days. So it wasn't just like he came to them on that Sunday morning or that next night. It's just periodically they were seeing him everywhere. And one of the wonderful stories about Peter, which is again on the Sea of Galilee, and there's a little stone chapel there, and there's the inside the chapel there's the rock where Jesus fried the fish, because he was standing on the shore, and Peter was in the boat, others were in the boat, and they looked, and at first they didn't recognize, and then they realized who it was. They realized that there he was, and they had known that he had died, of course, but then there he was, and then they talk about how Peter just jumped out of the boat and just, you know, came through the water. He didn't even wait to bring his boat in. And Jesus said, you know, bring fish and I'll fix breakfast. And you just think, what? But he was really there. And so then you have the rock where he fried the fish, which I just love. And it's a fabulous place. But think about that. Like, why not? Why are we not always constantly aware? Frank Laubach, Letters from a Modern Mystic. I was speaking of him last night too. He was supposed to be a missionary teaching whoever he was about Jesus, and he wasn't finding success by the conventional methods that were offered to him. He was in some isolated place. I don't know where he was. So he just started using the time that he was there to be in the constant company of Jesus. And then he writes about that experiment, and he wrote a number of other books that were actually basic practices of yoga, but he discovered them because they're basic practices of somebody who loves. If you love, you want to remember. So he developed all these different ways to constantly practice the presence of God. Like, when am I ever alone? And that was where Swami asked Master, when you are gone, will you be as close to us as you are now? And that's when he said, to those who think me near, I will be near. So how often are we thinking that Master's on one side and Jesus is on the other? Swami's sitting at the tea table with us. A very dear friend of mine who, he was part of Ananda, but his path was really, he was a disciple of Jesus. He was a very successful businessman. And in his office, he had a chair, a very nice chair, but it was placed in such a way that it wasn't convenient for anyone else to use it. But in his mind, Jesus was always sitting in that chair. And he just gave all the credit for all his businesses because he had a silent partner, is how he put it. But he didn't tell anyone about it. So that whenever he would go into his office, Jesus was always sitting there. And whenever he wasn't quite sure what to do, he'd just, you know, kind of look at the chair. I mean, the people in his office, he'd just kind of look over there. Nobody had to know what he was doing. But he always was hearing Jesus saying, follow me. And so this is this season that we have, because everything changes around Christmas time. And there's a real descent of spirit. It really happens. They say that all the celebrations in the physical world are really also happen in the astral world. When Swami had first written the chant of the angels, life mantra, whatever it's called now, It's that really complicated 11-minute piece that is all about life is a mission from on high, life is a quest for inner joy. And Swami heard a chorus of angels singing it. And he just wrote it down. He said he himself didn't know the chords he was writing. He just wrote down what he heard until he had it all there in front of him. And he had just published it or just printed it, and he was coming through Palo Alto, and about 6 or 8 of our singers learned it and performed it for Swami. It was actually the first time he heard it performed. And they told him that when they were learning it, that I think there were 6 of them, and they were singing it, and then they stopped singing, and 3 of them heard other voices continue. You know, no, not for a long time, but just another phrase or two. And it really felt like that they were being instructed from the astral world. And I believe it was Rajasi who talked about a birthday celebration on January 5th after Master's passing, in which Rajasi also saw the astral world celebration. And so a lot of times when Christmas is happening and it's all that, suddenly many people are remembering. And you know, we're always surrounded by higher beings. Everybody who goes has a death and return experience, they always talk about this extraordinarily densely populated, subtle universe which is all around us. And how much of the time we're being followed around by angelic beings who are trying to help us. Now, it's perfectly obvious when you think about it. And they also talk about those heavenly realms where higher beings are always trying to lift up those who are trying to ascend. So why wouldn't they be trying to help us? You know, this is their job. This is what they do. And whenever 2 or more are gathered together and the vibration is more inviting. So from this time, you know, during these weeks, you know, our holiday season tends to run from Thanksgiving to Master's birthday. You know, it's a long cycle for us, which is just great. In India, there's just festivals all the time. The festival season is what people call it. You know, and this one ends and that one begins, and this one ends and that one begins, because they're different. They delight in the celebration. They're not embarrassed to go down the street carrying a murti. But during this season, just every morning, just think of yourself. Here I am on the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus is asking me to follow him. What am I going to do today? And whenever our enthusiasm wanes, imagine our energy wanes, just imagine that Jesus has come and sit next to us. And maybe he just wants to go out for ice cream with you. You know, we don't have to be serious all the time. Swamiji took us to the movies. He took us to restaurants. Master, you know, went out with them, gave the boys money for ice cream. Swami still has a dollar bill that Master gave him for ice cream. It might be in the museum now. I'm not sure. Is that where it is? Swami just obviously substituted one of his own and kept the one that Master had given him. But let's see, also this is the part I wanted to say. You know, Jesus was young and very vital. And he gathered all these young men around him. And I can't remember the words from the oratorio, but it's like in their youth, in their joy, all they asked of God was freedom to love. And so that's the middle period. That's what we get to go through. And that's what gives us the power when the crucifixion comes to have the faith to go through it. When we were through those 12 years of litigation that we went through, and a lot of it got pretty tense. And I remember somewhere in the middle of it just saying quietly to someone, it's a good thing that I've had other experiences than this one, because if this were my entire spiritual life, I'm not really sure that I'd be able to carry through. But I had lots of other experiences that had built the reserves of joy, had built up the reserves of joy. So when life demanded that we call on those reserves rather than those reserves being fed, the fact of having constantly added to them with a conscious participation in everything that uplifts, you know, everything that uplifts. And it's very interesting to watch one's spiritual life, because oftentimes people will say, well, you know, I used to be so inspired and I'm not so inspired anymore. I said, well, are you coming to every Sunday service? Well, not as often as I used to. Well, are you coming to the morning meditations? Well, I used to come more often, but now. Are you coming to the Friday kirtans? Well, not anymore. Oh, gosh, I wonder why you're not so inspired. Gosh, this is really hard to figure out. Let me try to figure this out, you know. What could be the reason? So Christmas is a time to really build the reserves of joy. Welcome the baby, visualize the young man, and then feel the courage of the sacrifice. Just all of it at the same time. And there's a crack in the cosmic veil, and more of the infinite pours down to us. For each one of us, make it very, very personal. Even if there's 100 people in the room, Jesus came for you. I mean, Krishna manifests himself to every gopi, and Jesus loves each one of us individually, equally, infinitely, if we receive him. So.